Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from A Search to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about targeted therapy of non-small cell lung cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Justin Gaynor from the Mass General Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Karen Recamp from the Cedars-Sinai Cancer at Los Angeles, California. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As always, there's a 1 minute pre and post meeting survey in the chat room for you to take. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting. We know a lot of people end up listening to these webinars or into oncology audio. Check out our Oncology Day podcast series, including a recent program with Dr. Johnson. We do webinars all the time. Next week, we'll be doing another program in our year in review series, this time focused on myelofibrosis. And then we're heading out to Chicago, as we do every year, to the Hilton Hotel in that great ballroom out there. We're going to be doing 9 programs this year, but they'll all be going out live online as well for you to check out. But today, we're going to talk about targeted therapy. And in fact, that's going to be a big story at ASCO, one of the major stories at ASCO. As always, we'll be occasionally talking about non-FDA-approved use of agents and regimens. Please consult the package inserts for more information. So as we do in all these programs, I met with each one of our faculty individually over the last couple of weeks, and we recorded an in-depth presentation of a number of papers that have come out and presentations over the past year. And these are now posted in the chat room, and when we send out the recording of this event tonight, I will also include that. This is really a 3-part series. Ideally, it would be to look through these to start with and then check out what we're going to talk about tonight. Those of you who are on tonight are going to do it the reverse way. Well, I think it's going to be just as good. So as I mentioned, there's just so many papers that we went through that are really important and interesting, but you can check those out in the 2 presentations. We picked out a number of what we think are really important issues to talk about. And we're going to get into that in a second. We're going to get into some of the papers specifically, but we want to take a breath before we get started and talk about, you know, taking a step back a little bit and thinking about what we're about to talk about here today. So the first thing I wanted to point out to the faculty and ask what their thoughts were was the plenary presentation for Sunday, June the 2nd, which does have a very cool neoadjuvant melanoma trial, maybe not so exciting plot versus cross trial, but then 3 of the 5 papers, lung cancer related. First, one of my favorite investigators in research endeavors, Jennifer Temel at Justin's place, who's really done this landmark work over the years looking at palliative care. I can't wait to see this presentation on telehealth. You know, it sounds so logical. And then we're going to see the LARA study. Well, you know, we've been thinking about this ever since Pacific came out. What do you do with people with targetable mutations in the LARA scenario of chemo radiation unresectable disease? And we know this is, of course, going to be a very positive study, as everybody's pretty much been doing it already, but now we're going to have the data. And then Dave Spiegel is going to present the Adriatic study, sort of the Pacific, but now for limited stage disease. Not a huge surprise, but, you know, something to think about. So first, Karen, it looks like a huge year for lung cancer. I can't remember a plenary like this. Any thoughts, anything in particular you're looking forward to see here?
Well, we always are happy to see the data. And yeah, this is an exciting year for lung cancer. I don't think I've ever seen in my career 3 lung cancer thoracic oncology abstracts presented in the plenary session. So the telehealth versus in-person visits for palliative care, I'm excited to see an update from the study that was presented in 2010 and showing that this is still important for our patients, even though that they're living longer now with targeted therapy and immunotherapy. And obviously the LARA study with consolidation osimertinib will be really relevant to a lot of my patients, as we see a lot of EGFR patients on the West Coast. And then durvalumab, again, makes sense for patients in the consolidation setting, and to have data to support it will also be helpful. So I think we're excited to see the data and kind of get into the nitty-gritty to understand it better.
So, Justin, you know, just for those who weren't in oncology, a lot of people here today online weren't in 2010. We'll just mention the fact that this landmark study was palliative care at diagnosis of non-small cell, not end stages, at diagnosis. And these people live longer. And I mean, we're not saying this is like the perfect, you know, scientific study to prove overall survival, but they live longer. You know, people were saying at that time, if that were a drug, we'd give it. I'm not so sure we have actually given it, but anyhow, Justin, any thoughts in general about that and also these other data that's going to be presented in the plenary?
Well, first I would say super proud of Jennifer and Joe for having done this study and, you know, having data that's, you know, sufficient for the plenary. So we're really excited to support our colleagues. I think it's a critical study because one of the things that we've learned is that, you know, there's a massive shortage of palliative care clinicians. And so how do you actually take data, right, that we've known about from 2010, but actually scale it? And many institutions don't have enough palliative care clinicians. And so how can we start thinking about innovative ways to deliver palliative care? And I think that's where this is going to be really powerful. I'm really excited to see the LAURA data as well. You know, this is something that we've talked about for years in tumor board. When you have an EGFR mutant patient, you know, do you give Pacific or do you give osimertinib? I think finally we'll have some answer there. So we may have clarity for EGFR, but then I think it's going to open the floodgates to tumor board discussions about what do you do for ALK? What do you do for ROS1? I think we're going to be having some of those conversations over the next couple of years. And then finally, another major advance in small cell. I think this is, you know, a disease that in many ways has been less left behind the targeted therapy revolution. You know, we had the approval in extensive stage disease. So great to see now the benefits of PD-1 pathway blockade in limited stage.
So, yeah, I'm waiting for CD3 bispecific and small cell. I think it's coming. And I think the oncologists are going to be ready because of myeloma and lymphoma. But anyhow, super exciting. And also, just to mention that just as we were preparing this program, all of a sudden, April 30th, I forget it was last week or whatever, they popped up with an ASCO plenary on targeted therapy, another KRAS G12C. I watched the whole thing. I recommend. I don't know if that drug is necessarily this new drug out there, but the discussion was really great. So I recommend you check it out. Steve Liu did a great introduction, and then they had a great chat afterwards. But I want to just pick, before we sort of dive into all the specifics, I just want, again, to take a little bit more of a step back and think about something that, you know, Justin just sort of alluded to, which is, okay, you've got, you know, this, you know, now we have a trial in the post-chemo radiation therapy. We'll talk about that. But do we need to do another trial with ALK? And another trial was the other targeted therapy. And I bring up this pan-tumor approval that just happened about a month ago with TDXD, which is amazing and interesting and something you could talk about for a long time. But in a way, I kind of view this as, you know, kind of skipping over a lot of trials. Prior to seeing this this FDA approval, there were trials going on in, I think there was more research being done with TDXD in overexpressed disease in lung, and colorectal cancer is still not approved, even though they have great waterfall plots. They're doing more trials. And then all of a sudden, the FDA comes along and says, okay, it's approved. And not that you're not going to do that study, but now you're good to go. So the FDA was sort of okay with that step. And what I want to know about is, what does it take in terms of targeted therapy for you? I mean, regulatory issues are another issue. Expense is another issue. But just getting down to the risk benefit of a patient sitting in front of you and trying to make their, at least come up with a recommendation you think would be optimal. How much trial data do you really need? You know, Justin, we started this out with the so-called IPASS study. That maybe, again, people new to oncology might not remember, randomizing between targeted therapy. I think it was actually, was it erlotinib and chemo? Oh, gefitinib, right, gefitinib. And, of course, gefitinib blew it away, which, I mean, I don't know if people expect it or not, but that's what happened. And then, of course, you had similar data with ALK. And then actually, we saw a similar trial with RET fairly recently that a lot of people were upset about because they were like, why are you randomizing people to chemo And people are going, well, we don't know, you know, because it's a different mutation. So using that as an example, Justin, you know, from your point of view, what do you think it takes to bring targeted therapy, for example, into first line treatment?
I think it's a really important question. And I think there are multiple factors. First, I think mechanism matters here. Are we talking about, when we say targeted therapy, are we talking about a TKI? Or are we talking about an antibody drug conjugate, right? And what is the underlying insult or biomarker? Is it a oncogenic fusion, a mutation that we know so much about? We know it's a fundamental oncogenic driver of the disease. It's mutually exclusive with others. You know, for those, you know, we've now had, you know, examples of tumor agnostic approvals. RET's one example, NTRK's another example, where the genomic insult, you know, regardless of the context, is a driver. And so if you use a targeted therapy, you know, you're going to see, you know, good anti-tumor activity. Obviously, there are outliers, right? BRAF's one example of outliers, you know, colorectal cancer behaving differently, which is why I think you need to do post-marketing studies. You know, it's still, you know, just because something gets approved doesn't mean we stop studying it. And so I think that some of those things would then come out. I think it's very different, though, looking at an IHC biomarker, right? It's not necessarily a bona fide driver. An antibody drug conjugate also, you know, the mechanism of action is quite different, right? It has more toxicity. And that's the other factor in my mind, which is toxicity. How much toxicity are we seeing? What are the other available therapies for those patients? So TKIs and oncogene-driven kind of cancers, that to me, I would have the lowest threshold to extrapolate. It gets harder when we're talking about biomarkers that are a bit, you know, more promiscuous or therapies that have greater toxicity.
Yeah, that's really a great way to look at. Karen, I'm curious what your thoughts about it, particularly as we think about in the localized setting. So neoadjuvant, adjuvant, even post-chemo radiation, where, you know, some of these people, particularly in the adjuvant setting, are cured, so you're going to be exposing them. And then the issue is, well, what are you going to do about chemotherapy? So I guess my question to you is, now that we've, and we'll talk more about ALINA too, in terms of ALINA versus ADORA in terms of design, but just kind of curious right now, Karen, when you think about, let's just say a high-risk adjuvant situation, what are the targeted therapies that you would like to be able to use, like, right now?
So I like the principles that Justin pointed out. And again, I think that the targeted therapies, the oncogenic drivers, are much more reliable as biomarkers, and we see response rates, you know, in the 80 to 90% range in the metastatic setting. So I think it's oncogene-driven tumors and drugs with limited toxicity are the ones that I'm wanting to use in the curative setting to potentially reduce harm. I have a patient that I just got called by a colleague about who has stage 2 lung cancer, who has a ROS1 alteration. And they underwent surgery, and they said, "What do I do next?" And so it's relevant to our clinics and our practice every day. I think in this patient, I am going to recommend chemo as the standard, and consider doing a ROS1 inhibitor in the post adjuvant chemotherapy setting. But this is, again, driven by extrapolating from what we've seen previously in ADORA and ALINA.
So, you know, audience, I don't know what to say. You can see they struggle with this. It's a complex situation, but that happens all the time in oncology. Let's start to get more into the nitty-gritty of the data itself and then bring it back into some of the concepts we're talking about here. So, Justin, of course, we did see the follow-up now. This is a great slide that Karen put together in her talk, looking at how targeted therapy has moved up to earlier stage disease. And of course, I guess it was last year's ASCO that we saw the survival. That was a plenary, and the survival. Incidentally, I was kind of surprised. You know, there was even people who were wondering whether there was going to be a survival, certainly before even the trial, but even after the DFS was reported, it wasn't only survival, man. It was a hazard rate of 0.49. Did that surprise you, Justin? And any other thoughts about it?
It did surprise me that the hazard ratio would be, you know, in that range. I thought it would be a little bit higher. You know, not that, you know, osimertinib's not effective, but, you know, biologically speaking, you know, do I think adjuvant TKI is curing more people? I still don't think that we are curing more people with adjuvant therapy, even though there's a survival benefit. I think we're just pushing the curves out. So I would differentiate survival versus cure. You know, I think there are some, you know, still some question. So this is standard of care now, right? I offer it in all patients. I think we always have to be a little cautious in interpreting some of the survival data, because even though most patients had access to EGFR TKI who were in the control arm, it wasn't always osimertinib. It was what was approved, you know, regionally. And so they could have been getting first generation inhibitors. And we know that osimertinib is superior. So I think as we think about a lot of trials that we'll be talking today is, you know, what is access like, you know, in terms of the control arms? Because I think that is important.
That really is a great point. And, you know, more and more in oncology, though, we're thinking about, yeah, pushing the curves out, you're not curing them. But if you push the curve out to after they're 100 years old, it's a functional cure, kind of a CML type of a cure. So, yeah, maybe the word wouldn't be cure, but from the patient's point of view, pretty similar. These are some great questions that Karen talked about in her talk, to, you know, one being the issue of should we go lower, you know, when breast cancer, once they established that tamoxifen worked in the high risk patient, they started using it in everybody. Again, when do you apply data? Another thing we hear all the time, the issue of MRD. Anything you want to say about that, Karen? MRD and also lower stage disease.
So I think, you know, whenever I talk to our fellows about this topic, you have to understand that there are patients who are cured who we are over-treating in these cases. And these drugs, though tolerable and probably more tolerable than what we do to patients with breast cancer, they aren't without toxicity. And so thinking about ways to define patients who need more intensification or de-intensification of therapy, I think will be the next phase of what we learn and what we incorporate into this perioperative adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting. And so I think that MRD is definitely something we're going to be looking at and using to identify and understand who should be treated. But again, these are long trials. Patients are living a long time. So when we will get this data, I'm not so sure. And we may do a lot of extrapolating before then.
So here's the LARA trial that we're going to see in a few weeks. As always, there's a press release out there. I don't see too many press releases using the word overwhelming efficacy benefit, but you know, that's what you see with targeted therapy, you know, these hazard rates. So we'll see what the number is, but we've got a lot of great numbers previous to that. And again, some of the issues that come up in terms of EGFR mutations, a mutant disease, but also the issue of resistance and, of course, both clinical and sort of biologic resistance. Can you kind of provide, Justin, a little bit of an update of where we are right now in the patient who progresses on what's usually this first-line therapy of metastatic disease, osimertinib?
Yeah, so whenever I see these patients, I always talk about a framework for how we think about resistance to therapy. You know, I do think it's important to try to repeat your genotyping at that time. And usually we break down resistance into on-target resistance, that is new mutations in EGFR in this case. So these are things like EGFR C797S. You know, in contrast to the old paradigm where we used to, you know, treat with the first generation inhibitor and we saw very high rates of on-target resistance, i.e. things like T790M, rates of on-target resistance with osimertinib is much lower. We think it's generally under 10%. And that reflects better drug development. As we develop better drugs with that are hitting the target harder, we're engineering activity to overcome a lot of these resistance mutations. You know, we're seeing then more off-target resistance. And so by off targets, these are generally bypass signaling pathways. These are things like MET amplification, seeing that in like 15% of patients. We see various different oncogenic fusions. You can see RET, you can see ALK, but those are all relatively rare. Basically anything to reactivate the MAP kinase pathway, we can see. And then lastly, there's lineage changes. So things that, you know, where we see transformation to squamous cell, transformation to small cell lung cancer, all of those things can be observed upon progression with first line osimertinib.
So let's talk about potential alternatives to first line osimertinib monotherapy. That was covered in our discussion. Some of the big papers, of course, the FLAURA study looking at the addition of chemotherapy, the FLAURA 2 phase 3 trial, osimertinib plus or minus chemotherapy that Karen reviewed. And Karen, can you comment a little bit? I mean, there was a DFS advantage, which maybe not a huge surprise, but one of the things that was really interesting was the benefit in patients with CNS mets. So any comments about this trial in general and also the CNS mets issue?
So I think it's always exciting to see patients having additional options for EGFR non-small cell lung cancer. The addition of chemotherapy, we know that pemetrexed has CNS activity. So adding the pemetrexed-based therapy to osimertinib, I think that's why we're probably seeing some synergy and some prolongation of the CNS metastasis-free time and more benefit in the brain. I don't know that sequencing these wouldn't be just as well. And so I'm not pushing forward to give every patient with brain metastases the combination of chemotherapy and osimertinib at this moment in time.
So I was telling the faculty, we always try to come up with a pretest that'll really try to get into the nitty gritty. And we were trying to come up with a good scenario to talk about something that has been very standard first line therapy of metastatic disease. And now we're starting to see options. And now we have adding chemo. But the other thing we have is amivantanib and lazertinib, and lazertinib alone, I mean, which seems to be very similar to osimertinib. So, Justin, you want to take a crack at talking about your vision of how amivantanib works, what it is, risks and benefits, and in particular, what you think about this trial comparing it to osimertinib with lazertinib in the first line setting?
Yeah, so amivantamab is a bispecific antibody, so EGFR and MET. You know, we think it disrupts, you know, dysregulated oncogenic signaling. And so there's a lot of rationale, and we've seen over the years data with just amivantamab monotherapy showing activity in osimertinib-resistant non-small cell lung cancer. So this is a drug that's shown benefit, you know, response rates around that 30% range. And so a lot of rationale for combining it with an EGFR TKI in the upfront setting. I think we're going to keep returning, though, to some key themes in the first line of EGFR mutant lung cancer, because it's not just can we improve PFS. I think the question marks are going to be, you know, can we improve overall survival, and then is this a tolerable regimen? And I think there are concerns when you move from an oral therapy that you give patients, and you know, once you get through that initial phase and you say come back and see me every, you know, 3 months or so, to know you're now tied to intravenous therapy. And one of the other challenges with an IV therapy like amivantamab is that there are a couple toxicities that clinicians need to be aware of. One, very high rates of infusion reactions, particularly the first kind of first infusion. So you need to kind of split the dosing. And then two, you know, my experience has been much more kind of rash facial toxicity. And because it's a bispecific, that toxicity doesn't go away as fast. Right. You know, with the TKI, you stop the drug and washes out of the system pretty quickly. But with a bispecific, it can take much longer. And, you know, just as you can get synergistic anti-tumor activity, you can also see, you know, synergistic toxicity. So this was, you know, a positive study. You know, we see, you know, progression-free survival benefit with the combination, hazard ratio of 0.7. So it's a positive study. But is this something that's going to tip the balance and have me use it in the first line setting? I would say right now, no, especially when I know that I have data using amivantamab in the second line setting showing that there's preserved anti-tumor activity there. So I think this is encouraging data, but I don't think right now it's necessarily practice changing.
So I guess through indirect comparison, it might be kind of hard to figure out the efficacy comparison between FLAURA2 and MARIPOSA. But again, trying to figure out a scenario where you might consider something than most osimertinib monotherapy. So, Karen, I challenge you with a case of a young patient, young kids. They want to do anything they can to stay as long without recurrence for as long as they can. They don't care about toxicity or coming in. You know, I don't know how often you see that in lung cancer. You know, breast cancer, that's a lot of people because they're younger, I guess. But you have young people with lung cancer. A patient like that, let's say with or without brain mets, exon 19 or a 21, Karen, anything would get you to right now want to use AMI laser or OC chemo.
Right. I think it would be a discussion. And I think that given the synergy of the rash toxicity with AMI laser, it's a little easier discussion with OC chemo, I think, at this moment in time for a patient like that. But it would take a highly motivated patient, I think, at this moment in time, as we're trying to understand what biomarkers might help us understand who would benefit up front and need a more intensified therapy up front. Because a large number of patients do really well with osimertinib for years even, and don't need the extra toxicity and extra cost and extra burden of coming in for infusions. So at this moment in time, it would take a very highly motivated patient.
So our favorite chat person, Doc, just asked a question. Dr. K.S. Kumar from the FCS. I know he hadn't been here last week or so, but anyhow, he's back. He wants a pretty straightforward question, something we haven't talked about, and it was actually what we were going to talk about. What do you do in patients who progress with osimertinib? He wants to know chemo versus AMI laser, and I want to know what kind of workup you do. Does it change? But let's just start with this very interesting study. Justin, you want to comment on it?
Yeah, so we've talked about MARIPOSA, and now the relevant study is MARIPOSA 2. So this was also presented at ESMO, so large phase 3 study, you know, took patients. So the standard of care, right, so what I would generally do is I would repeat genotyping in that patient, you know, looking to see if I can find a defined mechanism of resistance. So we do see things like MET amplification in a significant proportion of patients. You know, so there I might shunt towards, you know, combination trials and things like that. But assuming, you know, you don't have any defined mechanism of resistance, the standard of care has been chemotherapy. So MARIPOSA 2 used basically compared chemotherapy, platinum pemetrexed, versus platinum pemetrexed plus amivantamab, or a quadruplet, chemo plus AMI laser. And, you know, my impressions of the data, so if you look at, you know, I don't think the laser added much here. You know, the data looked pretty similar, the quadruplet versus the triplet. I think, so in my mind, you know, the conversation is really, you know, is there a role for adding amivantamab? We could talk about brain metastases. That might be one of the cases where you do want to maintain a TKI, right? You know, there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival with the addition of amivantamab to platinum doublet chemotherapy, right? So it has ratio in around the 0.4 range. I think this is probably where there's more of a conversation with patients about, you know, you've already progressed on TKI. What is Is it worth now the incremental added toxicity with amivantamab? Have I done it yet? I have not. but I think this might be worth more of a conversation. The other thing I will add about this study that was also noteworthy was increased risk of venous thromboembolism with the combination, the AMI laser chemo combination. So it is, mechanism of action. I don't think we clearly have a clear mechanism of action behind that, but it is now warranting, prophylaxis in the first few months of treatment with that combination.
So Karen, in terms of, adding in the lazertinib, to me, it's like osimertinib. And if you think about it, there are people who add osimertinib, particularly in the beginning of therapy, particularly with people with brain mets when they have progression. So to me, it would be like if you're the kind of person who keeps the osimertinib going, you could, I guess, use lazertinib. But any thoughts in general, particularly about amivantanib in this relapse situation, Karen?
So I have used amivantamab in a number of settings and was part of many of the trials. And I'll say that if you can get through the infusion-related reaction because they split the initial dose, and most patients do have they have an infusion-related reaction, and then the next dose they receive goes without any problems, along with pre-meds. And they have a pretty good algorithm for starting patients on the drug. So it takes a lot of education of the patient and the staff, but it's definitely doable. And I've seen patients respond, and I don't have any specific biomarker that can help me, but patients have responded with that have had multiple therapies, that have had multiple complex genomic alterations, and I've seen responses. The issue with the brain, we see in this study that they did have intracranial disease control, and that was even without lazertinib, which I don't know that I can completely explain except for potentially some synergy. But it can be an active drug for some patients. And I think that I'm excited to have more options for our patients, and we'll be using it. I think it's going to go forward with chemotherapy without the lazertinib because of the toxicity issues and the efficacy that we saw there that was not so different.
So a quick word about something that we've spent as much as 2 hours on and could probably spend more, which is ADCs, antibody drug conjugates, and lung cancer. We're just going to briefly talk about a couple of agents of great interest. So patritumab, really interesting agent. Justin, maybe you can talk about what it is. I was kind of surprised that it was being looked at in recurrent EGFR, but tell us about the mechanism and why it works.
So it's a HER3 antibody drug conjugate. It's easier to say that than the name itself. It doesn't really roll off the tongue, but I think we do know that various HER family members are overexpressed in these tumors. Interestingly, the biomarker analysis, it hasn't panned out. So you actually see activity regardless of HER3 expression. And below the waterfall plot there, the bottom area is the HER3 expression. It's like regardless of HER3 expression. So it's perhaps you just need, a bit. I think this is encouraging data, a response rate of 30% in patients previously treated EGFR mutant lung cancer. I think it's encouraging. Having used drugs like this, it's still though I view it like chemotherapy version 2.0. It's still got a lot of the toxicity, that we associate with chemotherapy, cytopenias, nausea, et cetera. And so I think what we really need for the HER3 ADCs is a better biomarker. And so far efforts really haven't discovered one yet.
So yeah, I remember I think it's being studied and has activity in breast cancer. And I remember at San Antonio, Mark Pegram was saying, with an ADC, you're just looking for a little bit, like you just said, it just has to be there, latch one and, kill the cell. So not exactly the same as some of our other targeted therapies. Karen, here's another really interesting agent. We're hearing not also in breast cancer as well as lung cancer, Dato-DXd. Can you talk about that, and in particular the issue, because of course we had two big presentations on at ESMO on lung and breast as well, and the overall trial, as we see here in this data, is interesting because there's a difference in terms of what the histology was. Also interesting in terms of the tolerability issues with this ADC. And then there was more data specifically with this agent in people with actionable mutations. So Karen, can you kind of review where Dato is in terms of patients with targetable mutations, or at least EGFR, I guess?
Right. So the Dato-DXd data presented at ESMO, as we saw there, I didn't show the overall survival or the overall progression-free survival. I separated it by histology, because the overall progression-free survival was modestly different between the Dato-DXd and docetaxel, which I think was a little bit disappointing. We've had so much hope for these ADCs, and to see a modest benefit over docetaxel is not really what we were looking for. When they separated it out, the non-squamous seemed to do better, and those were patients with and without actionable genomic mutations. Obviously, the majority of these patients are going to be patients with EGFR mutation, and so bringing that forward and looking at a group of patients with actionable genomic alterations, or AGAs is what they're calling them now. This is an early look at the study looking at Dato-DXd, and as you can see in this study, they're looking at Dato-DXd. The majority, more than 50%, have EGFR mutations, so that group is pulled out. You see in the middle column, and here we see that the response rate is kind of in the probably 30 to 40% range. And so you see a common theme here of kind of 30% plus or minus responses in this refractory setting for EGFR patients. But we're seeing responses. Some of them are durable responses, and again, progression-free survival in about the five-month range. I think the exciting thing to me is that the mechanisms of action are different for all of these agents. So potentially we could be sequencing these and potentially improving overall survival by sequencing these therapies for our patients.
So Justin, curious about tolerability with Dato. Of course, one of the interesting things that you don't see with some of the other agents is mucositis. I've been asking the breast people, do the usual things you use in breast to prevent mucositis work, you know, mouthwash, et cetera. They say yes. When I talk to the lung people, I'm not so sure what's going on. Have you seen much mucositis, Justin, and can you prevent it?
Yes, I've seen the mucositis, as reflected in this data here. You know, it's 10% grade 3 or higher. So it's definitely different than a lot of the chemotherapies that we use in lung cancer, right? You know, pemetrexed is one of our go-tos. So you definitely see more stomatitis, more alopecia with this. We've then done more kind of mouth care, rinses, things like that, steroid rinses and things like that, which can help, but it doesn't prevent it completely.
So here's another great slide, Karen, put together some of these issues that we've just been talking about. But let's talk about exon 20 EGFR as well. Karen, can you talk a little bit about, again, what exon 20 is and some of the new trials that have come out this past year?
So exon 20 insertion mutations, we've been looking at these as other EGFR mutations for a long time now, and these are known to be not sensitive to our standard first generation, second generation, and third generation EGFR TKIs. So osimertinib hasn't been an option for these patients. Our frontline therapy for these patients has really involved chemotherapy as the standard. We have had amivantamab, which is FDA approved in the second line setting for these patients with exon 20 mutations, and they wanted to move this now into the first line setting. So again, it's the same amivantamab that we just discussed, the bispecific antibody for EGFR and MET, and they compared that to chemotherapy and found a significant improvement in progression-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.39, so very, very significant, and median was 11 months for those patients who received the combination. So the interim overall survival is still very early, but patients didn't have any detriment to their survival with this combination. Toxicity might be as you expect, which is the rash and diarrhea and edema that you can get with MET inhibitors, but overall, and you can see more cytopenias with the combination, but overall the patients were able to tolerate it, and again, a significant improvement in overall survival. So I think this is an area where we have really lacking therapies, and I have a little an easier time to move forward pretty quickly to add the amivantamab to the chemotherapy in a patient who can tolerate it and use that up front. But again, we do have second-line amivantamab, at least in the United States, so access is another issue. There may be places where you cannot get this agent, but the sequencing of chemotherapy followed by amivantamab, we don't know that whether the patients would do just as well with the sequencing with less toxicity.
So, Justin, what does that have you generally doing clinically?
So I follow a pretty similar approach as that outlined by Karen, in that I am now thinking about the upfront combination of amivantamab here, really because I don't have a TKI combination that's standard. Unfortunately for exon 20, this year we've kind of gone backwards once because we had mobocertinib was approved.
Right.
And that was actually voluntarily withdrawn. Unfortunately, we can look at the Papillon study, right? And maybe that's, we give some guidance, although, in how the study was done, right, it was added to chemotherapy, whereas the mobocertinib phase 3, it was versus chemotherapy. I don't think that's great science necessarily, to like just combine onto platinum doublet chemotherapy, but, in this case, it led to a positive study. So, I think we need more studies looking at next generation TKIs for the exon 20 patients. And there are several, in development right now.
So let's talk a little bit about MET exon 14 alterations. And Karen reviewed a couple papers from this past year. But Karen, can you talk a little bit about what MET exon 14 is, or what MET is in terms of a driver, and a little bit about how we can approach this therapeutically?
So MET exon 14 skipping is a little different than some of the other mutations that we see, and often happens in the juxtamembrane position. And there are a multitude of alterations that can occur that are included in MET exon 14 skipping. But what we see is that they have responses and similar types of efficacy when we use MET TKIs for patients with MET exon 14 skipping. So this is another oncogenic driver with two options as targetable FDA options as targetable agents. And then there's the other issues of MET amplification and other types of driver alterations for MET, which are a little bit different than the MET exon 14 skipping and don't have as much data supporting the MET TKIs.
Justin, let me ask you, does this fit into your concept of, what you were talking about before, I'm not sure the exact wording, but you were referring to TKIs and true targeted therapy as opposed to, say, an ADC. What are the agents here in MET? And also, what about MET overexpression, Justin?
Great question. So I think MET exon 14 skipping, we think of as a true oncogenic driver. It leads to dysregulated MET signaling, and we see response rates in treatment naive patients of like 60%, and it's generally mutually exclusive with other drivers. So I think MET exon 14 skipping, is one of those, distinct alterations. That's different, though, than I think MET overexpression by IHC, even MET amplification, at the copy number level. Those are instances where I don't think of them as true drivers, and there can be overlap with other oncogenic alterations. So those are places where I wouldn't necessarily extrapolate.
So would this fit into your vision of something, Karen, for example, that if you could, you would consider adjuvant or post chemo radiation therapy in a patient with a MET exon 14 mutation?
So that's an excellent question. And I think if you asked me a few years ago, the answer would have been unequivocally yes. The more experience I have with MET inhibitors, I will have to say that even though the main toxicity we see is edema, this edema can be profound and disabling for patients. And so, and the problem is, it causes hypoalbuminemia, and the edema accumulates over time. And so the longer you're on it, the more significant the edema. So I think in the neoadjuvant setting, in a short term, not necessarily an issue, but I'd really like to see some data before I'm going to commit somebody to a 2-year course of MET inhibitor in the adjuvant setting.
So Jada in the chat room says, aside from targeting the oncogenes and tumor suppressors, are there any non-small cell therapies targeting epigenetic regulators? Example, increasing methylation to inhibit overacetylation activation in MET. Sometimes I just read these things and hope they are logical. This one sort of sounds like it is. So Justin, you want to take a shot at that? I never thought about it. Epigenetic regulators.
The short answer is no. The longer answer is that, you know, 10 years ago or so, you know, that there was some early work from the Hopkins team suggesting that actually if you can use some epigenetic priming, so using things like HDAC inhibitors for a short course and then following it up with PD-1, that perhaps you could sensitize more tumors. And that was based on, you know, more anecdotes from one of their trials where they had a couple lung cancer patients who got, you know, an epigenetic therapy and then went on to a clinical trial of PD-1 and had unexpectedly good outcomes. But my understanding is that the subsequent studies really haven't held up. And so right now there is not a role.
A little bit more from the chat room. So as mentioning, Thoy from the chat room says, I have a patient with stage 4 adenosquamous with exon 14, currently on a MET inhibitor, doesn't say which one, doing well. I wanted to ask what second line therapy would be on disease progression. And then she added another entry into the chat room a little bit later saying, how do you manage the profound edema from a MET inhibitor, dose reduction or holding therapy until resolved? I don't know whether her patient's having that problem or not. But Karen, any thoughts about second line therapy and what do you do for the edema?
So the second line therapy, we really go toward chemotherapy and immunotherapy. There are mixed reports on whether PD-L1 expression correlates to responses with immunotherapy. So I'm not sure we would utilize immunotherapy on its own as monotherapy, even in a PD-L1 high patient. But generally, we're thinking about chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And then there are next generation inhibitors that are being developed. But for the edema, I think it is really quite challenging because the edema takes time to develop. It also takes time to resolve. And so just holding for a few days or for a week is really not something that helps it to resolve. So really it's about education and leg elevation, compression hose, wraps from the very beginning. And really having patients be motivated to take care of the edema and the gravity issues with the edema. But it's really a management thing and a lot of compression hose, compression arm sleeves, things like that. But it's a chronic problem that they're managing. Lasix and other diuretics really don't solve the issue for most patients.
So the chat room is blowing up here. We're getting so many things I can't even begin to comment on them, but thanks for these ideas. We'll definitely get to them at some point. Justin, in your talk, you were talking about what we know about these agents in the first line setting. It's hard to separate the two that are out there. And you know, you kind of came up with a take on overall your view of these patients and how they can be managed. I wanted to just throw out another question that came here from the chat room from Adley about patritumab. Wants to know more about side effects, sequencing, and something I don't know anything about, exon 20. Justin?
So side effects of patritumab, the HER3 ADC, you know, are generally very similar to the other ADCs. So it's cytopenias, it's nausea, vomiting. It's very similar to your other ADCs. What is the activity of HER3 ADCs in patients with exon 20? I'm not aware of data, but biologically, I would expect it to be comparable, or at least that's what I would hypothesize, because it's, you know, the distinctions that we make with exon 20, right, are just because how it affects drug binding, but they have a lot of the same clinical pathologic characteristics as your classical mutations, right? Never smokers, all those things. It's just a matter of drug binding. And so I think it's worth, you know, thinking about HER3 ADCs in those patients.
All right, so let's talk about HER2 and particularly T-DXd and particularly this new approval. And I guess maybe we can just take a breath and go back and again talk about this molecule specifically, where it's been and where it's heading and how it works. Karen, can you talk a little bit about your vision for this ADC and why it seems to be so effective, but also having an interesting toxicity profile? And you know, we had a trial, and we never thought we would see this, but when ADCs came out, but there was a trial actually in breast cancer comparing T-DXd to another, you know, T-DM1, another anti-HER2 antibody ADC. And, you know, nobody knew what it was going to show, and it just totally blew it away. So one can definitely be more effective than the other. Karen, what is it about T-DXd that makes it different?
So I think, you know, the ADCs have their antibody, they have their linker, and they also have their payload. And so I do think the deruxtecan payload is something that is potent and more potent and able to get into the tumor more easily. And so I think it's the potency issue. And we see these, all the DXd drugs that are showing activity kind of across the board. But I think that the payload is the active part of this, and the toxicities that we see with that payload are similar across the board with all of these agents. And they differ a little bit based on the antibody. But I think we are seeing that these are more potent than some of the other antibodies. And we saw that with TROP2 also, with SOCI, Govatecan, which did not have a positive result compared to docetaxel in non-small cell lung cancer.
So yeah, actually, Justin, I was thinking the fact that actually the approvals for overexpression, IHC3+, and the most common issue that you're using it for is actually HER2 mutations, which is, you know, in breast cancer, they have very few HER2 mutations, almost all overexpression. But you guys have a lot of HER2 mutant disease, and that maybe even responds better. You have an approval there. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of HER2 mutant versus HER2 overexpressing? And I guess really this approval really just focuses on overexpression.
Right. So in lung, we actually have three distinct HER2 alterations, right? So I think we'll have to be careful with our nomenclature moving forward. We have HER2 mutations, which are mostly in the kinase domain. We have some, as you can see in that figure in the upper left, you know, some are in the transmembrane domain, some extracellular domain. The studies actually for T-DXd allowed all of them. We also have HER2 amplification, and then we have HER2 overexpression. They're all relatively low frequencies, so HER2 mutations are like 2% of lung cancer. And HER2 overexpression in the 3+ is also single digits. But the rationale for HER2 mutations being sensitized to an ADC actually came from some elegant work by Bob Lee at Memorial, where essentially in the setting of a HER2 mutation, you actually get increased cycling of the receptor from, you know, basically from the cell surface being internalized. And so you can imagine, like, that's perfect for an ADC. So if you're getting increased cycling from the cell surface, then you're getting increased uptake of that ADC and increased internalization. And so the thinking is that's probably what's driving the increased response rates in that group, because there you're seeing 60% response rates. For overexpression, the rates look a bit lower in terms of anti-tumor activity.
So, Karen, you know, out here in the general medical oncology, where we hear about T-DXd from the GI people, from the breast people, now we're hearing it from everybody. But one of the things, again, that's very of great interest to all these groups is brain activity. And initially, there was question of whether or not it would have any CNS activity. And then in breast, they started to report it. And now you've got some data, too. Any comments, Karen?
So I think it's always exciting to see a drug that has brain activity, because our patients do have, many patients have brain metastases and they become refractory to therapy. So seeing this, again, it's not just common sense that an ADC would have activity in the brain, but this is, again, as you said, across multiple tumor types, they're starting to see this brain activity. So it's exciting to see. These are small numbers, and we'll see how that plays out in their bigger trials.
So to be continued, as things move up earlier in all these diseases, we'll see where T-DXd lands. But of course, one issue we must discuss is the issue of tolerability and toxicity. I think we alluded to it already a little bit in terms of GI toxicity, but I really want to focus on the issue of interstitial lung disease. And rather than go through a lot of slides, just really talk to you about your vision for this. Justin, of course, again, topic in every single tumor type that we talk about, but here it's a little bit different because you have a lot of people with pre-existing disease, and they may be symptomatic before they even start the T-DXd. So can you talk a little bit again about your take, particularly in patients with lung cancer, right now that we know about this and we're active in terms of trying to screen for it, to pick it up early, what you see, what you say to patients in terms of what the risk is?
I think it's a critical point because, you know, with DESTINY-Lung01, first off, you know, it first explored a higher dose, a dose that was different than the dose used in breast and gastric, right? First, it was using the 6.4 mg per kg dose, and we saw higher rates of pneumonitis and ILD, so rates of 25% or so adjudicated ILD, which ILD not only is it causing symptoms for patients, but then you're never going to be able to get a patient onto a clinical trial, right? Because they're labeled as having pneumonitis. So it's really a devastating label to place, both in the acute sense and then the rest of that patient's journey. So I think, you know, DESTINY-Lung01, then there was the subsequent studies with T-DXd looking at the two different doses, and it really looked like, you know, the lower dose, the 5.4 mg per kg dose, you know, I think strikes the right balance in that we see much lower rates of pneumonitis now in that like 7 to 10% range, while actually preserving anti-tumor with response rates in that 50% range. So I think that's the dose that I use, you know, that is the dose in lung cancer. But I think you need to be vigilant for these patients, especially patients coming off checkpoint inhibitors, which we know there's risk there. They did do subgroup analyses looking at the differences in the rates if you had checkpoint or not. Didn't seem like a marked difference, but you need to be vigilant for these patients.
So, Karen, I always ask the investigators outside of breast, do they follow the breast paradigm? So let me tell you what my interpretation is, what I've been hearing from breast people about ILD. First of all, of course, you know, in addition to asking for symptoms, but they mainly focus on screening CT. And they try to get it as often as they can, and insurance will allow them. They'll do it every 8 or 12 weeks if they can for a long time because they want to pick it up at grade 1 before the patient gets symptomatic. Very aggressive about CT screening. And then if the patient has symptoms, you know, grade 2, they usually will not restart therapy. Of course, you have to individualize it to the patient. And incurs a grade one. They have all these things about you have to have resolution in 28 days, et cetera. I'm not even going to ask you how you deal with people who already have problems on their chest x-ray, et cetera. But let's just put that aside and think more purely. How do you see the quest to pick up ILD? And do you manage it in terms of if they do develop it in the same paradigm as breast?
So I think ours is going to be a little bit different because we're doing CTs of the chest all the time on these patients. And as you mentioned, they have lung disease, they have tumors, they have their lungs tend to be not normal at the baseline. And so we're often not catching very subtle things. In the rare patient, we're able to catch those subtle things and see that grade one ILD. So we're really looking at symptoms. And our patients have shortness of breath and cough as baseline. And so it's looking at change in symptoms, frequency of symptoms, and then obviously, so I think our threshold is probably a bit higher. And, you know, I'm willing to see a little bit of a hypoxia, but once I start to see hypoxia, then I get worried. So I think we're used to taking care of lung disorders, and we have a little more threshold to let a person be uncomfortable with pulmonary symptoms. But we're always very concerned about that. With all the therapies we give, we have issues with ILD, and so it's always on our minds.
So Karen and Justin, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back next Tuesday, I want to see not only what Dr. Gerds thinks about these two trials adding agents onto ruxolitinib, I want to know what he thinks about the Mediterranean diet. But anyhow, be safe, stay well, and have a great night.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks,
Justin. Take care.